Welcome to the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. Thank you so much for making it out here on your lunch hour here at the Commonwealth Club. We do a taping of the program here every Thursday, but today it's a special treat. We want to give thanks to our major sponsor, Pacific Fertility Center, who makes programs like the Michelle Meow Show available. And also thank you to Ceremony Ford and the Castro Car Guy for providing lunch for us today. I mean, Ike's sandwiches, you just can't beat that. Yeah. And now for our special guest today. I'm Michelle Meow. My co-host is John Zipper. Our special guest is the regional president for AT&T. He's in charge of public policy, philanthropy, heads and leads 45,000 plus employees, an overall amazing guy. Some of you have already reached out to me, excited to hear him speak. Let's give a warm welcome to Ken McNeely. Ken.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Michelle. Thank you.
Okay, so it's tradition here in the program that you share a coming out story, and I really have to hear it from your own words in terms of what you will share, but also to address the fact that you served as a cheerleader for a few years for the North Carolina Tar Heels and shared the same court as Michael Jordan when he made the winning shot in 1982 to clinch the NCAA title. So don't forget that in your coming out story.
I think you just told my coming out story.
Thank you so much. My coming out story, I grew up in North Carolina, so it was kind of a gradual coming out story, I guess. I was certainly out to friends in college for a long time, but it wasn't really until I'd graduated from college that I actually came out to my parents. And it was one of those interesting things. So I was a little bit older. I was about to start law school, and I had unfortunately lost one of my dear friends to HIV/AIDS. And I just felt like it was an opportunity for me to have a discussion with my mom, and I did have that discussion. And I remember we had gone out. She had come to visit me. I was living in Atlanta, Georgia at the time. And she had come to visit, and we had had this wonderful, incredible weekend. And it was over breakfast, and I was pouring coffee, and I was saying, you know, I don't think we have these kinds of discussions anymore. You know, we've been so candid, and it's been great to spend some time with you and one-on-one. And she said, what do you mean? We talk almost every day. And I said, well, you know, you mean, you know, the real discussions where, you know, we really kind of share things. And she said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, as I'm pouring coffee, I said, you know, like the fact that I'm gay. You know, and then I thought at that point she'd, you know, certainly choking her coffee, but you know, she paused and she took a sip, and in a very dramatic fashion she said, well, it's because I've always known. And I said, well, really? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, how long have you known? And she said, probably since you were 10. And that little Deborah thing, I knew that was a passing thing, a passing fling. And I said, well, I guess you do know me very well. And then she kind of rattled off the guys that I dated that I thought she thought were just friends. and we, you know, it's been a wonderful, embracing and endearing experience since. So.
It's awesome.
It's kind of the positive experience you'd hope people would have.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't have asked for a better response, but my mom's an incredible person.
Yeah. Have there been any negative hurdles because of your sexuality?
Of course. Yeah. Of course. You know, I mean, it's, you know, I started my career, you know, I went to law school and did well, and I clerked for the Supreme Court of North Carolina and decided to go back to North Carolina at the urging of the justice that I'd worked for, because at that point, this was maybe in the late 80s, there were no African Americans in any of the large firms. I mean, you know, so I didn't even kind of deal with the LGBT issue. I mean, just going back as an African American attorney in a very large firm was a big thing. And so I did that, and I was the first, and the firm had a written policy that gay lawyers could not become partners. And
they actually had a policy.
They had a written policy. I mean, as we all know, there are no federal protections, and only only state law protects for LGBT discrimination in employment. So they had every, you know, until this day, and I mean, North Carolina does not have protections for LGBT employees. So they had that policy. You could be an associate, but you could not become a partner in the company. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I'm both African American and LGBT. My life is limited. I mean, my career is limited here. And so, after a couple of years, I started to look for other employment. And I thought that corporate America would be a little bit more forgiving and understanding and embracing. Actually, not just forgiving, but celebrating. And I was recruited by AT&T. Interestingly enough. Interestingly enough, I was accepted the position with AT&T in Atlanta, Georgia, and I was put in charge of all the legal work in North Carolina. And and so as a result of that, I got to, you know, select outside counsel and work with the lawyers representing AT&T. And AT&T has always had a very strong non-discrimination policy,
yeah.
And we require that of all of our suppliers, our contractors, outside counsel. And so with great relish, I interviewed my old law firm and asked them about, well, how many African American lawyers do you have? How many
wow.
How many of them are partners? How many LGBT lawyers do you have? How many of them are partners? And complete silence. And I thought, I said, you know, you guys do great work, but you're not a good fit for AT&T.
Wow.
And so it's really, you know, it was great opportunity to for them to have that learning experience. They have since changed their policies, and you know, it's a very quick example of what it means to have LGBT representation in decision making roles, and how that can impact change.
I like the questions you're asking, which is actual how many do you have working in various categories? Because if you're just looking at what's your policy, you can always change a policy and we just can't find any African Americans to hire. So you're actually
absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
I want to get into, you know, AT&T's contribution to the LGBTQ community and the work that you've done in the last few years that you've been there. But before we do that, I mean, there's so many LGBTQ organizations here in the Bay Area. I was just wondering if you had any plans to be a part of CheerSF, since I'm going back to the whole cheer
thing. Oh, you're going to let go of the cheer thing.
And maybe that, like, you would probably do a cheer or two.
No, wow. No, you know, when I first got transferred to San Francisco, and I have to say that I was transferred here in 2000, and it was like coming to Oz. I mean, it was like this. It was this dream that I had of this place, shiny place on the hill. And if you grew up in the South, that's the way you think about San Francisco. You read a lot about it. You know that, oh my God, this is like, you know, everyone embraces everyone. And when I actually got here, I think I moved to Noe Valley, and I got to see San Francisco, CheerSF, and it was like the embodiment of all of that tolerance and exuberant feeling for the area, all wrapped into one, and a wrapping that I could identify with, having been a cheerleader. But yeah, I was that back at Carolina during the days of Michael Jordan. He and I were friends because we all hung out together and traveled together.
Interrupt. Did he know you were gay?
Yes, he did.
And he was?
No, absolutely fine with it. And it was, you know, college campuses, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It was a very tolerant place,
mm-hmm.
An oasis, really, in North Carolina at that time. No, I found it to be, Chapel Hill to be a very tolerant place, and the people there.
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, the Michael Jordan thing was cool, but I thought it was even more cool that you were a cheerleader, and here you are. You're the regional president of AT&T. But, you know, what's important about your role, many of us in the LGBTQ community know how important it is for many of us. You could be a grassroots activist to, you know, a CEO. We need all of us to really start implementing and executing programs that sustain our community. AT&T has one of the longest, and maybe probably was one of the first companies to establish an ERG group. I think it was established back in 1985 or 1987, somewhere around there in the 80s, which is very impressive. You got to AT&T and it had already been established for a few years. What was, you know, the experience like? It sounds like you got there and you already were out and thriving and they really embraced you as, you know, a gay man.
No, I think one of the things that it certainly attracted me to AT&T was the fact that it was and had a reputation of being a very embracing place. And what really struck me was really an opportunity to be my authentic self, because I knew that if I didn't have to worry about being somebody that I'm not, I could really be an incredible contributor to the organization. But even in that environment in the mid to late 80s, it was still a journey for me. I mean, when I started with the company in Atlanta, Georgia as a mid-level lawyer, I was out to a few people, but not really. I mean, I still, your personal life was your personal life. And it really wasn't until, I started to move up in the company, and I think that I had a track record, and really coming out to California, and then I could really kind of embrace myself. And I think that, I could actually see myself reflected in the community in leadership as well. And I think that empowered and emboldened me and gave me the courage of the numbers to really live authentically. And I think that really started to change. But I think that really the most, outing event at all was my starting a family. Because when you and your husband adopt two children, nothing says I'm out and proud than having your toddler scream daddy and papa in a crowd, and that also gave me kind of a common language with everybody. I mean, we were all kind of struggling to raise our kids. And so if others felt uncomfortable about asking me, what I was doing over the weekend as a single person, they certainly wasn't hesitant to ask me, how's that school application process going? Because we're all going through the same thing. So it gave me this common language that everyone had. But I think that over time, I became more confident and I think able to kind of drive my own agenda in a sense.
Let's talk about initiatives at the workplace. I mean, recent headlines, sadly, tragically, suicide, bullying is still something that impacts the LGBTQ community. A 9-year-old from Denver had just committed suicide after coming out and being bullied. AT&T has just pledged $1 million to the Trevor Project and is donating. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's Trevor Project being an organization that's suicide prevention and anti-bullying. So if you could talk about that, the specific initiatives over at AT&T, the LGBTQ initiatives that you're leading and why it's important to you.
Sure. It's interesting. When I first got my position as president, I remember a senior officer at the company once saying, asking me, once I'd started some LGBT initiatives, he asked, do you want to be known as the gay president? Why are you doing so much in this particular community? He says, do you want to be known as the gay president? And I was like, but I am, I mean, nobody would ask me, do you want to be known as the black president? Mm-hmm. It is who I am, and our life experiences inform us in whatever we do. And you may not identify, you may not claim it, but if you are a straight white male, your life experiences inform your decision making. They inform how you engage the community, and so my own experiences inform mine as well. I now happen to have resources to be able to help make decisions and more importantly, inform decisions in ways that may not have happened in the past. And so I think that one, our life experiences always inform our decision-making. And so my life experience, as I've shared with you, is what it is. And so I understand, so having the ability and the authority and the responsibility to kind of make decisions on how we engage the community, my job is to really understand and have my finger on the pulse of our community, to really reflect those values in the community? And how can you not do that in the Bay Area without having a significant impact in the LGBT community? Having experienced and being part of that community myself, then I know firsthand how the community can benefit from that. So, we had pledged $100 million in the company some years ago through a program where we were really trying to address high school dropout, and we realized that government was not going to be able to do this on its own. We really needed to look at public-private partnerships. So we wanted to make a difference, and so we wanted to really focus AT&T's philanthropy on high school achievement, particularly in underserved communities and communities of color. And so we started to focus on that. And then I knew firsthand and anecdotally that for LGBT youth, one of the biggest challenges was bullying in school, and the ability to really be able to attain that degree and then move on to high school was a large part involved in bullying. So I was able to then pivot from high school achievement to really anti-bullying campaigns to kind of pull in the LGBTQ community as well. And how can you look at bullying and its impact on our LGBTQ youth and not look at the Trevor Project? And so I became involved with Trevor, really understood, and really it really spoke to me. Particularly when you look at some of those, for those of you that may not be familiar with Trevor, it started as a suicide hotline for LGBTQ youth. And many of those calls come from places that I recognize mm-hmm. in North Carolina, in the South, and in particularly the South. Most of their calls come from that area. And so I really got involved with them. And then I realized that, calling centers for youth, that's become kind of old-fashioned now. No one makes phone calls anymore. So being an LGBT executive at what was once a phone company, which is now a mobile entertainment company, I wanted to help them make that transition. So I really felt it was really important to give kids another form of communicating their despair, another form of communicating crisis through texting. Hmm. So we really wanted to help them launch Trevor Text. Wow. Because it gave them an opportunity to communicate without having to talk to their parents or people or saying who are you on the phone with. Mm-hmm. They could text a hotline and get the kind of response and support that they needed.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Yeah. I also, I think some of you in this room know, have tried to call me. I don't like to talk on the phone, too. But John, I'm hogging Ken.
Well, I was just wondering, as you're talking about the philanthropic focuses that you have, how much of this, I mean, do you have a team that helps you come up with, the funding and dealing with these groups, or how much of... At what point are you the decider, as George Bush would have said?
Well, ultimately, but I really try to empower my team because, I have community affairs managers throughout the West embedded in the community throughout, and their job is really to understand the community. What's important to Bakersfield is different than what's important in Oakland, which is different from what's important in, say, Campbell or Eureka. And so we really try to understand the needs of the community. Those managers have their own budgets, which are, I distribute at the beginning of each year. And so they have responsibility for identifying those sources.
And it must be really satisfying to be at a place where you're talking about, when you said 100 million at first, I thought, I'll bet he misspoke. 100 million?
100 million.
I mean, you guys can really make differences. I mean, so many foundations and companies and individuals who are very generous and do make gifts can only dream about being able to have that kind of an impact. Do you ever wish you could do more? Or are there different things you would like to be able to take on in addition if you had even grander?
Well, there's always, as I appreciate the compliment, but as much as we invest, there's always more to do.
Yep.
And yes, you can solve some issues with dollars, but I think how we carry ourselves in the community, how we engage the community, and how we leverage we leverage ourselves can help make a difference as well. You know, earlier we were talking about our recent acquisition of Time Warner, which gives us now Warner Media, which includes HBO and Turner, CNN, and Warner Brothers Studios. And that this is part of our journey to create content distribution together, mobile entertainment. But one of the things we just announced today is that we're going to create a diversity compact. We believe that we want to see greater diversity in Hollywood. We want to see greater diversity in film. We want to see diversity in front of and behind the camera. So a lot of the workforce development that we're doing now are in communities of color and underserved communities where we're getting these stories told, and we're getting training for people to create their own content. Because when you think about mobile content, we're not only producing content for the big screen now, and which has traditionally had a very high degree of risk, and so a very very reluctant to really take chances. Mm-hmm. But if you think in terms of the future being around mobile entertainment, where you can create a 30-minute episode that you could subscribe to on your mobile phone, the opportunity to create more diverse content and take a risk for a certain community and focus it to that particular community is greater. So that creates greater diversity in front of and behind the camera.
We were also talking before this program.
And when you're talking about contributions, the leverage there is that my guess is that other studios will follow.
We were also talking earlier about the fact that AT&T is not known as an entertainment company. You know, the former Ma Bell taking over a movie studio. Is there a culture shift? And what do you guys bring to Hollywood, for example, I guess, that maybe Hollywood needs?
Ken's cheer.
My cheer. Well, I think one of the things that they bring is that I no longer have to wear a white shirt and a blue suit anymore, so I can actually dress more comfortably. But I think when we started thinking about content and about engaging Hollywood, we thought that we really needed to evolve, and that culture would overtake, and rightfully so, the kind of what was Ma Bell. But of course, then we all know things started to happen in Hollywood that weren't necessarily a great reflection on the people and the organizations there. And it really caused us to reflect a little bit and to think about, you know, we are a 140-year-old company. Oftentimes I refer to it as a 140-year-old startup. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to reinvent ourselves. So we must be doing something right. We have a culture of giving. We have a culture of tolerance, a culture of giving back. And I thought, what a great marriage of the creative kind of free-for-all with kind of a disciplined, connected, and empathetic parent, you know, and the coming together of those two entities. So I do think that there's a great intersection. I think it is unleashing a creativity in us that we have not seen before, but it is also providing some discipline, an understanding, and sensitivity to each other and the communities in which we work and live.
Do you get to see every Time Warner movie for free now?
I'm working on that.
Well, that's a great segue then to, I have a lot of questions.
All right.
A lot of questions about the merge of Time Warner and AT&T. I mean, right when, you know, the merge was happening, it was also, there was a lot of things happening government-wise or policy-wise, one being net neutrality and consumers are concerned about how net neutrality or without it, the withdrawal of it, and the FCC's decision to get rid of that will impact their consumption of media and internet and access to, you know, data and just being able to communicate or to access to independent content providers, as you had mentioned. So it's refreshing to hear you individually as a leader in a big company like AT&T, because I think your personal experiences will really shape what AT&T and the Time Warner merge can actually do in the future. But just to really, you know, ask you the question of kind of what your views or your thoughts are, and maybe help the general consumers like myself and those sitting out here and our fears that we won't be able to have access if we don't have the money to do it individually, if you get what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great question, Michelle, and thank you for asking it. You know, I do think that the proponents of net neutrality have overstated or misstated rather the position of, you know, I can only speak as a distributor for as AT&T what those claims are. AT&T had made net neutrality commitments to the federal government years ago, and we continue to keep those commitments, notwithstanding the decisions of the FCC and what the FCC has done under this new administration. One of the challenges that we face, though, and one of the contentions that we've made known in California has been an attempt to create different rules state by state. Because when you're a global company and you're trying to distribute content worldwide, to have different rules in one state versus all the other states is unworkable. And so our preference is for a federal solution. That it really is for Congress to make that decision, and for Congress to, we hope, to create or to write into law the commitments that we've all made. If there's any concerns about backsliding, rewrite those commitments into law at a national level and have them apply to everybody.
So vote come November.
Well, I mean, that's very timely, because California is in considering legislation, and you do kind of then wonder, well, okay, what is Nevada going to do? What is Texas going to do? Illinois? It seems for businesses you have that challenge, and then you also just have the challenge of, say, there is a federal approach. Having it change every time Congress flips is, you know, it's like if you know it's going to be one way, even if it's not your preferred way, at least you can plan on that.
Right.
But if you kind of have to be prepared to always have whatever you create to work with whatever system upended, and every time you know, a political hot potato gets tossed around.
Exactly. I mean, it makes it very challenging to plan. And the other thing is that and the other reason, you know, a level playing field is required, because with new technologies, you know, what was a phone company or phone call even has changed over the last 5 years. And so the kinds of companies that compete with us now didn't even exist, you know, 10 years ago. And so when you want to create rules, you want to create rules broad enough to encompass everybody so that the entire ecosystem is playing by the same rules.
Do you think that this is the beginning of the end for television? I mean, you know, the good old plug into the wall, turn the dial, and something comes up. I'm speaking for people like me who...
I have a 12 and 13-year-old, and I don't think they've ever seen a television with a dial on it. And it would probably scare them. They wouldn't know what to do with it. Our home phone rang one day, and I think it scared my kids, and they asked me if I could change that ringtone. You know, we are way beyond that. I mean, I think, you know, we live in a world now where you answer your television and watch your phone. And I mean, this is our future. Well, it's not our future. This is our present. This is our present. And the day has come now where you consume far more, maybe not you personally, but consumers consume much more content in front of a screen while walking, running, hopefully not driving. But you know, than sitting on your couch, you know, and it is the way we live, and it is particularly for younger people their only way of consuming content.
Speaking of technology and new technology and high tech and Hollywood, one of Hollywood's big changes as the internet kind of metastasized all over the place was piracy and theft of stuff. Does AT&T's tech resources and know-how and planning offer any sort of hope for all the creators of being able to be more in charge of distribution and monetization?
Well, so. You know, I think that's a great question. And I think that's really one of the upsides for the content makers. You know, I think one of the, when we started working with the DirecTV and looking at content itself, I think one of the exciting parts from that deal was the support that we were starting to get from content creators, mm-hmm. because they were now thinking that we have some control over the content that we're creating. Because I mean, the biggest challenge for you know, the stars get their money up front, but if you're working behind the camera, you get your money based on dollars coming in, people watching and rewatching the content that they've created. And these skilled laborers who work so tirelessly to create the content that we enjoy don't get paid if it's pirated. And they've been very, very supportive of I think where they see this going, mm-hmm. and being able to really have a better control over their creative process.
We're going to open it up to the floor for questions in just a little bit. So start thinking about what questions you'd like to ask Ken. And John's going to walk around with the amazing mic. but I want to make this come full circle. It's very, very, very exciting to hear you and your enthusiasm and talking about, you know, technology, media, and also with a philanthropic mind. Even if the LGBTQ community has come as far as we have, you know, with marriage equality, as you had said, there's so much work that needs to be done. I mean, I read you're the guy who met your husband when you, I think, had a Yahoo email account, and not to put age on it, but I'm saying that connection, being able to socialize, being able to text for emergencies, that's still so vital to the LGBTQ community. What do you see is the work, not just anti-bullying and suicide, but to ensure that the connectivity, that it's still there for our most marginalized and vulnerable of our population?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, what we're seeing, it's interesting that when we talk about that, because we talk in terms of the journey, and when I mentioned, you know, AT&T being a 140-year-old startup, and we think in terms of the home phone and Mom Bell, and the fact that my kids have, you know, it scares them with the home phone rings. You know, there is this transition going on. We do have an obligation not to leave anyone behind, and in this journey, this technological journey. I mean, we've had universal service for phone connectivity for generations. When I started with as president, right at about 2001. You know, we had about 12 million home phone lines, traditional home phone lines in California. Now we have almost less than a million traditional home phone lines in all of California. Now, many of you have home phones, but they're not using traditional home phone technologies anymore. They may be fiber, voice over IP, and then depending on your age bracket, you may have never had any type of home connectivity. And don't want it, and see it as an expense that you don't need. It was accelerated in 2008 during the financial crisis as people made financial decisions about what they wanted. Almost universally, people, if they had to make a financial decision about what kind of communications device, they chose a wireless phone over a connected phone at home. So we are seeing that. But we do. We also know is that not everybody is making that transition. Though we have seen wireless devices being probably a more democratic adoption of technology than we've ever seen. Really, without regard to socioeconomic, because there's so many options available: prepaid, postpaid, cards and all. And now we've been working to be able to apply the Lifeline subsidy, which is the low-income supplement, to make it technology neutral so that you can apply that supplement to any type of service that you have. And those are the kinds of things that we see allowing for connectivity throughout the state without regard to income.
It's interesting talking about wireless and that being an enabler. I remember reading about, you know, other countries, especially even third world countries, where wireless just took off because they didn't have the set infrastructure in there. And so in many ways, they were, you know, technology was developing and getting spread much faster there than here, where we had to make that decision of, do I go with this or this? Should I finally cut that line? It's like, well, this was the first thing they got.
Yeah, absolutely. Leapfrog like technology. Where, you know, if you didn't have universal connectivity, there you didn't have to make those options about, you know, it's much easier than to put the, you know, the cell tower up.
Yeah.
Questions? Who'd like to go first?
I should just try throwing the mic, but probably wouldn't work. Here you go, sir.
Hi, I must commend you on having texting available to the LGBT youth. But my question is, how do you reach the young people who are on the small towns that don't know where to call or now where to text to get this information?
That's one of the things that the kinds of resources that we're trying to give to Trevor, I think, can be very helpful in that, where they're actually trying to partner with community-based organizations in those areas so that the word can get out about these opportunities. And we're also partnering with, we had the Love Loud Festival in, of all places, Salt Lake City, Utah, where we filled an entire stadium. And I think one of my mentors and a person I admire quite dearly is Tim Cook at Apple. Mm. And where he, in front of, you know, 80,000 fans in this audience, said, "My name is Tim Cook. I'm CEO of one of the largest companies in the world. And I'm a proud gay American." Wow. And to cheers. And this was in Salt Lake City in support of LGBT youth, also with supporting the Trevor Project and getting those numbers and resources out to as many people as possible, even where they may not have that private connection. So working together with community-based organizations in areas there where they may not readily hear about it is important.
Great. Another question?
Hi, thanks for coming and speaking with us today. It's a real pleasure to hear your stories. My question gets into something Michelle alluded to earlier in her Dial-E television comment, her question, which is, as these traditional technologies disappear, airwaves, phone lines, things like that, it seems like universal access needs to kind of be a broadband question. And that is having access to broadband for everybody in their homes. You know, when the TV stops working, when the phone no longer works with the dial, how are these people going to get their information?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And that's something that the FCC has been looking at for a number of years, universal access to broadband. I mean, broadband is the new form of connectivity. Many companies now, both the traditional telco companies and other companies also, are looking at deploying broadband. In fact, now, in most instances, if you have new construction in most parts of the state, you're going to get fiber instead of the traditional copper lines now. And it's an understanding of broadband. Now, that works if you live in urban areas. Some of the challenges are in the more rural areas of the state, and you probably heard about 5G that's coming. The 5G capability really allows for greater speeds over the wireless network. So you're going to have in many instances the wireless network being as fast, if not faster, than the wireline fiber network. And that's really important for the rural areas, where it's much easier to put a tower up than it is to run fiber between homes that might be spaced significantly far apart. But I agree with you. Broadband is going to be the mode of connectivity. whether it's wireless or wireline.
Mm. Hi. Thanks so much for that really inspiring story. I have kind of a personal question about leadership for you. It seems to me that a lot of leaders from underrepresented backgrounds get put in a position where they have to overextend themselves on multiple fronts and not just be a leader, not just be a spokesperson for the company, but also take on either the emotional burden or just overextending in being invited to diversity and inclusion events constantly. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad thing, and correct me if I'm wrong if that is a tension at all for you, but I'm curious how you deal with that and whether you feel it's a burden or if it's something that you feel is a duty, or how you just deal with the emotional aspects of that, and how we as maybe forthcoming leaders can expect to handle that kind of thing.
That's a great question. Wow. I'm trying to figure out how to respond to it. I see it as a duty, obligation. But it's almost something that, in many instances, you can do without great intentionality. I mean, because one thing, I'll just give you an example. I'm often invited to speak at LGBT, events or attend or support LGBT causes. I'm also invited to speak significantly in the African American community. I don't change the resume depending on the audience. And so my African American community organizations know that I'm also LGBT, and my husband is there or introduced or is on my resume and my introduction. And I think without having to do anything differently, I'm making a difference because of just being my authentic self and not changing who I am and not leaving certain parts of who I am out depending on the audience. So you actually make a difference simply by just being your authentic self and just showing up fully to wherever you are and not altering it. When my boss told me that, do you want to be the gay president? I am the gay president, and so you may not, if you don't see my family, you may not know that, but if you know my story and you really care about knowing my story, you know that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that just by being your authentic self and showing up fully, you do that. But I do think that we do have an obligation also. I believe in this concept called windows and mirrors, that it's important for people to see themselves reflected by looking in the mirror, but it's also important for people to be able to look through a window and see people differently from them who have achieved as well.
Great.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you for this beautiful testimony and living out loud those values of authenticity. I'm wondering, I'm very excited to see that more and more leaders are willing to be out, come out and be out about their political views as well. And it's a fine line. And so I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to the role of the private sector as we continue to see this rise of, I'm very worried about the religious exemption pieces, for example, and the relentless attacks against foster families and children in foster care and really the prohibition against LGBTQ adoption and fostering. So how do you see the role of the private sector in having this courage and leveraging your power across the country and globally to move public policy?
Yeah, and that's one of the challenging pieces as an executive of a publicly traded corporation. And, our obligation is to our shareholders. And increasingly you're seeing this real intersection between social justice and what are your values as a corporate entity. If you truly care about your customers and your community, do you take a stand? And if you take a stand, who's going to be upset? And because you're kind of out there, you're not a political entity. You're kind of out there to provide services for everyone. But I think what has happened, particularly over the last few years, but I would say it's been an evolution over the last decade, particularly where these social issues have bubbled up, for AT&T, and I know for many other companies, and the tech sector has been very, very vocal and supportive. And so we do live in a very special area, but we also live in somewhat of a bubble as well. But I think companies can and should and must take positions on these social issues if they truly care and have policies that are internal. I mean, we have to express ourselves when we see that our employees especially are under attack. We have an obligation to protect them, to make them feel safe, to give them equal rights. And a lot of the social activism from corporations really come from within that desire to make our employees feel comfortable, protected, and empowered. And we have taken positions, particularly over the last several years, about this religious freedom. And we understand this is something that continues to bubble up, but it really. Questions and challenges a company's ability to kind of live and celebrate itself and create its own rules. And so I think that companies have an obligation to continue and to not be quiet and silent when their own values are under attack as well.
Great. Hi. I grew up a closeted trans girl in Kentucky. So what you said about San Francisco being the shining light somewhere when you grew up in the South, yes. Same way for me. And I just wonder, Pride does a great job of making sure we're that shining light for people in the South. But how do we make sure that kids growing up the South know that we're here? I mean, what stories are being told and what's AT&T involved in that make sure, as what may be content, but how do we make sure that message is still getting to those people?
Well, that's a great point. And I think we all have an obligation to do that, by going home and being ourselves and letting folks in our birth communities understand they needn't have to move to San Francisco to feel loved and comfortable and safe in their environment. We need to deliver messages of hope. We worked very closely with both the Los Angeles Gay Men's Chorus and the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus in sponsoring love tours. It gets better tours across the South, and it was not only concerts but also engaging with community-based organizations in that area, in those areas, and in many instances working together, particularly in the South, with religious institutions, many of whom are quite tolerant and engaging and embracing. And it was really rewarding to see that, and AT&T sponsored that tour, and it was a real opportunity for kids and young people to understand that it does get better.
Hi.
Hearing
you talk reminded me of the fact that, like, I think it was in the early 90s, I first started facilitating diversity programs. AT&T was one of my first clients.
Oh, wow.
You were one of the first, and we were in Washington State, up in the wave, only white people forever. But they also included in the program, they included LGBT, which at that time, even though a lot of companies were doing diversity, I'm actually this another Fortune 500 company that took quite a while before they would even allow us to use the word LGBT. And being a lesbian at the time, I thought, well, do we have a place at the diversity table or not? But I wanted to make a living, so I did what they told me. But it's different now. I don't care. But my question to you is, oftentimes, you have an organization like AT&T who has some amazing programs. You do some great work. But does the message trickle down? How does it get? Because you hire people from the population wherever they are. So some of those people may not have that message. So what kind of accountability process do you have to ensure that the person going to somebody's house, like going to a gay person's house or going to a black person's house, that they are not bringing their homophobia or their racism with them? How do you ensure that the message goes from the top to the bottom and all the way back up to the top?
Yeah, you know, that's another great question. And thank you for the work that you do. And, you know, even though we've been doing it at AT&T for many years, it's always a journey. It's always a learning process. And, you know, we hope to get better at it. It's a great question. I mean, you know, when you have over 300,000 employees across the world, many of whom are domestically deployed here in the States, in every state, in every community, we are a reflection of the community and the division in the community with our employee ranks. But what we do insist upon is that we have a collective set of values at work. And that these are our values. And we're going to treat everyone with respect, and that everyone will feel safe in our workplace. And which is why we were one of the first companies to create, I think the first company to have insurance benefits for our transgendered employees and for transitioning employees and supporting them both through their medical and psychological needs and supporting that in their return to work. And, you know, as one of the largest publicly held companies, not 1 year passes where there is some shareholder who introduces some type of shareholder resolution that challenges our non-discrimination policy or something that we've done. But I think being able to have a very firm and committed set of values, it is who we are. And I think, and it's all the way to the top, that it's unwavering. And I think that those employees understand and know that. We had one instance where we were we announced the Trevor $1 million support internally within AT&T. We have internal communications where people can respond to certain announcements and things like that. And overwhelmingly, it was positive. This is a great example of engaging the community, and we're so happy to be part of AT&T. But then you're going to have certain people who chime in these open anonymous forums where they're not so happy about this. And people might ask, why do we even have to talk about this? Or why do we, you know, people will question that. And all of that is, you know, it's monitored. And then our, you know, of course, our human resources chimes in, you know, remind you of our code of conduct and our corporate values. And so you have that, and so we're no different than America. But I think what we can say is that the values start at the top, living authentically and having people know who's around them in their community. I think familiarity breeds greater comfort, and so I think that being able to live open and honestly, or work open and honestly, and being your authentic self really changes.
Donna.
Ken, could you address this thing that bothers me? As a fundraiser, I appreciate corporate support. I mean, we're delighted when somebody says yes, and maybe they say yes before we even ask, as many times AT&T has done. But there is a group that says, you know, we don't need that corporate connection. I'm offended by the fact that they have two blocks of people walking in the parade. It takes too much time. What do you say to those people, especially in our LGBT community, that say, let's just have a smaller parade. We don't need that money. It doesn't need to be that big. I don't want to be in bed with this bank or in bed with this corporate entity. How do you address that, or do you?
Well, you know, that's really interesting because, I'll address it two ways, Donna. Thank you for the question. You know, oftentimes in our community, there's a reaction to anything that's corporate. You know, if it has incorporation behind it, then it must be bad. Particularly in our community, in the Bay Area, you have companies, you have employers who are truly committed to wanting to make a difference in their communities, not only in their communities, but also with their employees. To deny a company an opportunity to march into the parade is to deny its employees an opportunity to show their pride for being LGBTQ and their pride for being an employee of whatever company. And that's our opportunity to celebrate ourselves. And I think it would be a real lost opportunity. I mean, we're not, you know, we're hoping we're not just doing it to write a check to the Parade Foundation, but to really give an opportunity to celebrate our employees, those employees to celebrate their employment, and for us to celebrate, we are happy that you are here with us.
Hi, you spoke briefly about being a gay dad, and that's a somewhat unique experience as a gay male. So as a fellow gay dad, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about both the opportunities and the challenges that that can present.
That's a great question. Why we could do a show on that.
Yeah.
You have to invite me back for Day Dads.
Trust me, I will.
You know, okay. First of all, I could say it is magical. You know, being a dad is magical, and I wish more men would have that opportunity. It's been transformative, but it's also been the most challenging job I've ever had. I can do the president of AT&T in my sleep. Being a dad is challenging. I now have preteens, and you know what that's like. So that part has been it's been really rewarding, but it does come with challenges. I realized early on that most literature, it's all about the connection between moms and dads, and so you have to reconcile that and kind of talk about what that means. I remember when I we don't use the word mom much in our house. We have daddy and papa. And I remember when our kids went to preschool, they came back, my daughter especially, mommy me. And mommy, you know, schools are very mom-centric places for pick up and drop off and volunteering and things like that. And so my daughter thought that mommy meant pick her up, give her a hug. And it was because when the moms would come to pick her up, pick their kids up, they'd get the hug. And so she would say, mommy me, you know, and so you pick me up and give me a hug. And so you go through that process. But the other thing is that you realize that there's a lot of parenting networking that goes on between moms and about the sharing of advice and what works, what doesn't, and all these kinds of things that I really have to kind of struggle to kind of insert myself into that group. And so that's been a challenge. What society, if you are a guy with a 6-month-old getting on a plane by yourself with your 6-month-old, it is like, either you are super dad and everybody's so helpful and they're applauding you because you're doing this great thing. And then you realize, oh my God, women do this every day without the applause. And we get this applause, or you get this, oh my God, they let you out with that baby, so you get those looks as well. So I do think that it is a learning experience, it is a rewarding experience, it is a journey. It's a journey that I'm glad I'm on.
Wow. We've got time for one more question, and then I have the last question.
Uh-oh. My name is Dr. Hassan Z. I am a medical doctor and a filmmaker, and I was invited by Michelle to come here today. So I was quite inspired by your talk and your story. And I just want to give a suggestion. You are in a position at AT&T where you can make a difference in the lives of LGBT community. And you talk about being authentic and being yourself. But if you go into these southern small towns, people might just... I mean, I'm talking about myself. I might go back home, Pakistan. I might get killed just being authentic and being myself. So my suggestion would be, what can AT&T do? And you as, on such position, maybe in the logo... I think we need to educate people. And in the logo, it can say, we embrace all genders. Or something bigger than just, giving money here and there and little bit here and there. I think that in this position, you might be able to do something a little bigger. And that's just a suggestion. But what would you say about it, though?
No, sure, sure. I mean, I certainly appreciate that. I do think that I think that we can make a difference. I think we can do actually more tangible things than putting words in a logo. I think what we can do is that we employ people in every state. In every state of America, we employ individuals. And our rules are not regional rules. Our values are not regional values. Our protections are not regional protections. League, our LGBT employee resource group, is as popular and in existence in Mobile, Alabama, as it is in San Francisco. In fact, it's needed more in Mobile, Alabama. And those employees know, you know, we can't change the world, but we can change the world with inside the boundaries that we have. You can come to work. You can be promoted. You, without regard to your LGBT, in many instances, because we want to celebrate your difference, and in fact, that could be a value add that you're bringing to the table. And so you can be your whole self. You know, I can't change what you might be doing in the community, or your family situation, but you can come to, the company and you'll have, a company that values and celebrates you. And I think that knowing that brand stands for that and our engagement in the community and being a safe place to work and promoting and celebrating can help change, because other companies are doing the same thing, and that starts the snowball.
I want to, Ken, I get the last question. I want to thank you so much for being here. I mean, it really means a lot to myself, and I'm sure everyone here, and those tuning in through Commonwealth Club and Progressive Voices Network. My last question really touches on it. First of all, I want to validate, you know, the fact that what you're doing at AT&T is just so incredible. As the company merges with Time Warner, it becomes one of the most powerful, biggest global media, internet broadband companies there is going to be out there. I think AT&T is very lucky to have an individual like you who can start to shape this and make it so that it balances. So that's the key word, the balance. As the company continues to have LGBTQ policies, hire LGBTQ people, one of the things I find when talking to my corporate friends who work for a lot of these large companies is that I'm just going to use Brad as an example. So I apologize if there is a Brad here. But Brad will be Brad outside of work, and then there's Brad, you know, at work. And even though Brad can be out at work, the Brad that is actually not working is very different. So, for example, I would imagine that you may not want to display, you know, a photo of you and your husband at Folsom Street Fair on your desk at work. And so, you know, there's that element, and then there's, you know, kind of something similar to some of these companies are going through, in which down to the service, the customer service that turns away an LGBTQ person, as Renata brought up with religious freedom, and then that employee of that company is part of a company that has gotten 100% on HRC, the HRC index, or, you know, has marched in the Pride Parade for over 25 years, or has given $1 million to the Trevor Project, that there becomes a disconnect. I think that we need more leadership. We need more gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer people in leadership like yourself, who can then be authentic and create and shape the policies that goes from just a social, you know, construction of being LGBTQ inclusive, but to empower that it also is safe for LGBTQ people to be a part of the corporate culture. I know that was a really long last question, but I think that how you can respond to it will give hope to not just the community, but also if you're employed by a big corporation, and if you're thinking about how to implement diversity and absolute inclusion at these corporations. That's what I'm looking for, is the words of hope beyond, you know, just be yourself.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great question, Michelle. And I think a constant refrain of mine has been authenticity, And I know that it's not always easy. Because it wasn't easy for me when I was growing up in Charlotte, North Carolina, nor when I first arrived in Atlanta, Georgia. It's gotten easier over time. In part, you know, the Bay Area certainly was kind of unleashed me in a way that had not been before. But I think time, with the change of time, and I think being in a position where you're able to see and be seen, being authentic, it really starts to make a difference. You know, if I'm being celebrated internally and externally for the kinds of work that I'm doing, the exposure that I'm getting, it is making other junior employees, giving them the confidence to come out, to be out, to live out. We recently celebrated one of the scientists, one of our top scientists at AT&T has transitioned from male to female. And she is one of our top scientists. In fact, created a drone that allows for cellular coverage to be flown over fire, so that first responders can communicate with each other while because of the towers go down during the fire, they need this kind of connectivity. She gets celebrated in a very big way. And that starts to knock down these walls, and it starts to make people, remember I talked about windows and mirrors, that people need to see themselves reflected, and people need to see through the mirror, to see people differently than themselves, achieving at very significant levels. Mm. That creates this comfort, that creates the opportunity, that creates the desire to want to be like them. I mean, if you can't see it, you can't be it, you know? And so part of being living authentically, working authentically, loving authentically, is that you can then represent yourselves to the greater community. Here I am, and here, and you know, like me, you know, love me or not, this is who I am. And you know that you've accomplished, maybe not in spite of, but because of.
Love it. Let's give a round of applause, a great round of applause for our guest, Ken McNeely.
Thank you.
Ken.
Thank you. I so enjoyed this.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you to our major sponsor, Pacific Fertility Center, and, of course, Ceremony Ford for providing lunch. The Michelle Miao Show airs on Progressive Voices Network Monday through Friday, 4 o'clock Pacific Standard Time, Sunday on KBCW's San Francisco Bay Area, 712, and Channel 44 on the standard tube with the dial, or the antenna, however you want to do it. And thank you. We're here every Thursday at the Commonwealth Club. Thanks to the Commonwealth Club for making this happen, and where we invite LGBTQ thought leaders into the conversation to make change. So make change today. Make it happen.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for the Michelle Miao Show, your A through Z, covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. We're here every Thursday live at the Commonwealth Club, and you can listen to past shows at
commonwealthclub.org/MMS.